seat in the front row.
No, we'll just sit in the front row.
Yeah, but then, well, in the end, if it gets full, we reckon they'd rather have the seats at the back.
Stupid on Saturday. Well, it really did surprise me. We went to Northern Ireland at the end of April, so I booked flights, $200 a day. I went and booked the flights to Dublin, not Belfast. I'm so used to, I'm going there, must be. So, no, yeah, Ryanair, so they're going right, rigmarole, trying to get them changed.
Done things like that.
It's annoying because you can change flights, but because Belfast is in the UK, it's not coming. It says we don't fly to Belfast International, so what do we do? You know, so we have to like phone them or something now to try and get it sorted out. Very outrageous. And then before you ask, we're not going to see him, Paisley.
Not a son, though, presumably.
No, Carl pays it. Ian pays it, Junior. No. Carl pays it, I know.
Still trying to get the. Yeah, he's trying to do it now. He's struggling a bit. Yeah, that could be useful if you could do that. Yeah, just because Jeremy's got to print half of it, but I haven't got my bit.
I probably should have sort of thought ahead and printed your half off as well. So.
I'll try and be paper free. People in the front row now. The clock's not quite right, actually. It's a little bit, I mean, apart from being 2 hours wrong, but
it's about 5 minutes. So yeah. The clock is about.
So if we aim to finish at 5 o'clock, that'd be pretty good.
Because 5 o'clock would be, yeah, about right, really. So if I had to finish about 4:30,
I think by the time I've got things working, yeah, it'll be at 4 when you start. You finish 4:30.
Well, they're going to be a bit preamble anyway, so.
Yeah. She's some. think she's trying to get a printout. Yeah, so that we'll probably live with that. Jeremy's doing the first half, and he's got print off the first half.
Smile, everybody.
Right, I think we'll make a start. Jamie, don't worry. Don't worry about the iPad. Good evening and welcome to this evening's programme talk at the Staple Inn Actuarial Society. My name is Natanya Olofsa and I'm the Honorary Secretary of SIAS. Before I introduce tonight's talk, I've got a couple of notices about upcoming SIAS events. Our next programme talk will be a discussion on future mortality improvements, chaired by the CMI Mortality Projections Committee. This talk will take place on Tuesday, the 6th of March, and you can register from tomorrow online. On the subject of online registration, I know we've been going through a few changes, so we're eager to get this process up and running and as smooth as possible, so we'd welcome any feedback from you guys. We'll be sending out a short online survey tomorrow. Our next social event is a poker tournament next Wednesday, and we hope to see as many of you there. We've still got some few tickets if you are interested. And then a few standard notices about tonight's event. The attendance sheet in the smaller room needs to be signed by you all for CPD purposes. So if you didn't sign it on the way in, don't forget to sign it on the way out. And attendance at these talks does not get automatically added to your CPD record. And then if the fire alarm sounds during the meeting, please exit using the fire exits at the back of the hall. There is no test going on tonight. And then finally, a reminder to switch your mobile phones to silent. Right. So tonight's talk will last around an hour and be followed by a Q&A with the speakers. And we're very lucky to have two speakers with us tonight. We've got Ed Morgan, who became a fellow of the IFOA in 1989. He worked for Abbey Life, then Commercial Union, later Aviva, as chief actuary in Italy and group head of Life Development. He then founded Morgan Consulting in 1999, which was acquired in 2003 by Milliman, where it is now the managing director for Italy and Central and Eastern Europe. He lives in Lugano, Switzerland. Jeremy Kent became a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries in 1993, and he worked for Commercial Union, then Norwich Union in the UK and European divisions, becoming its first employee at Morgan Consulting in 2000. He is now a principal at Milliman's Milan office, but lives in the UK. Ed and Jeremy have recently published two papers, a valuation methodology for insurance companies under Solvency II, and measuring new business profitability under Solvency II. So these will form the basis of their talk for today. Right, I'll hand over to you guys to make a start.
Okay, thank you very much. Is this on? Hopefully everybody can hear, but I'll try and speak up anyway. I'm Jeremy Kent. I'm the considerably younger of the two speakers. I actually worked for Ed back in Commercial Union back in the day, whenever it was in the mid-90s, and I went to work for him again in 2000, so glutton for punishment, obviously. Just a little disclaimer, the views of the authors and not of SIUS or our employer. So, agenda for today, brief introduction to the subject, then we're going to develop our S2 AV methodology. Note the smaller 2 and S2 AV. A brief comparison with some other well-known and well-loved valuation methods, some further considerations, and then applying the methodology to new business value and profitability, which was the subject of our second paper, and then some conclusions followed by Q&A. Those of you who don't know, Shirley Temple, she was a child star of the 1930s. I think she lived till quite recently, but she was very forward-looking, and she saw the benefit of real-world projections, I think is what she had in mind. So very much we do owe a lot to Shirley Temple in the development of our paper. So where do we start? Well, Solvency II, again, well-known and beloved of us all, represented a radical shift in European insurance regulations, perhaps less so in the UK, as we already had realistic balance sheets and economic capital for some time, but nonetheless still generated a lot of work. But across Europe, it's fundamentally changed the way European insurers view risk and returns. Under the old Solvency I methodology, in many countries, pretty much capital wasn't really very well aligned to actual risks. The formula was 4% of reserves plus 0.3% of some at risk and things like this. So you could take different levels of risk and still hold the same capital. Under Solvency II, this does intend to reflect the actual risks you're holding. We started with this methodology thinking about how people may value insurance companies under a Solvency II regime, particularly in M&A transactions. We often find investors are interested in projected cash flows, and what they really mean by that is expected real-world distributable profits. So under a real-world view of future returns, how much can they get out in dividends and when can they get them out? Because if they're tying up capital in the business, they will put a cost on that. So the focus of our paper started off very much on valuations, but we do talk later in the presentation about wider applications around product design and ALM and so forth. So back in the day when we used to do these kind of M&A sort of valuations, we'd often look at Solvency I type projections of profits. So you'd have your statutory reserves, which are quite prudent, they'd have prudential margins in them. And we do a valuation a bit like traditional embedded value, and many of you are old enough to remember those. So you project statutory type profits, and you discount them at a risk discount rate to reflect the risks and or the shareholder's required rate of return with some kind of cash flow models for non-life. But under a Solvency II regime, the own funds in Solvency II already capitalise future prudential margins. It's meant to be a realistic view of liabilities, and you hold an economic capital based on something like the SCR on top of that. And there is a risk if you try to start thinking about that, you're going to risk mixing apples and pears, so a kind of statutory liabilities and statutory type profits with a Solvency II type view that already capitalises future margins and has an economic view of capital. Now we came to the conclusion that we believe that certainly in the longer term the main drivers of distributable profits are going to be the required level of Solvency II capital and the own funds which are available to cover it. So in the simplest case, you might project your own funds and say, if I've got own funds bigger than my required capital, I can pay a dividend. If it's less, I'll have to put some more money in to keep the company afloat. And this is really our starting point. So looking at future distributable profits. And our aim is to value those profits, calculate a net present value of those future distributable profits based on the shareholder or the investor or the potential acquirer's required rate of return. We're not saying this is the only way to value companies, but we think it's a good way to go, and particularly it's aligned with how I think many insurance companies do actually manage their businesses. But in practice, it's quite difficult to get these kind of projections. In an ideal world, you project your own funds, you project your required capital, you project it out, you know, for 20, 30 years or something, work out your dividends, discount them back at the risk discount rate. But in most situations, it's very difficult to get that, and particularly in an M&A, a sort of buy-side M&A type situation, it's very hard to get decent information. Having something like the Orsted projections helps, but they're limited and they're probably only 3 or 5 years. They're not projected all the way out. Business plan projections are often based on IFRS profits or something like that, so you run the risk of combining Solvency II view with kind of IFRS profits, and you're in apples and pears situation once again. And many of these types of projections do rely on big approximations in terms of projecting risk margin or projecting SCRs forward using risk drivers and things like this. And there's also the challenge of how do you project real world up to a future balance sheet point and then value your liabilities at a risk neutral basis at that point. So what our method aims to do is to try and decompose this value, which we're going to call Solvency II appraisal value, into different components, starting with things that you can find on your Solvency II balance sheet. And obviously with public SFCRs and so on, we're getting better information on some of these things. But if we can itemise our valuation, we can start with building blocks, then I think we can understand our valuation better, and it allows us to do something which is reasonable, and we can do, you know, these things quite quickly and potentially even with fairly limited information. And if we can decompose this value, it helps us into understanding, well, what is the value of different types of activities? You know, should I carry on selling new business? Should I change my asset management strategy and start investing more in bonds with credit risk and things like this, which we'll come on to later. So I think our methodology has the advantage that it can be done with, you can start with quite simple building blocks and build it up. And also it's applicable to life, non-life and health insurance. Anything that's covered by Solvency II, this method is equally applicable to. So, development of S2AV. So we're going to make some pretty sweeping assumptions here, but don't worry, we're going to build on these. But let's just start off and assume that we're going to take no hedgeable risks. Or rather, if we take hedgeable risks, we're going to hedge them immediately after the valuation date. So what does that mean? It means we assume there's no capital requirement, and we're going to assume standard formula SCR at this stage. There's no SCR for non-hedgeable risks. And we can make the assumption here, or we all will make the assumption, that our projected SCR then is equivalent to what it would be back in the risk margin calculation, which reflects non-hedgeable risks only. But there is a difference in that you're not allowed to allow for loss of solvency capacity of deferred taxes on the risk margin, but as we'll see, we're going to start off with a tax rate of zero. So we're going to make that assumption, and we're going to assume that really assets and liabilities are, to help us with the algebra, kind of matched going forward, and there's no mismatch on assets and liabilities at all future points in time. We're going to assume no future new business, so this is going to be on a Solvency II definition, so all business that we're going to value is within the Solvency II contract boundaries. We're going to assume we can manage the business on a required capital of 100% of standard formula SCR. Sweeping assumption, which we're going to build on later, but let's just bear with me for now. No tax or tax rate of zero, so there's no loss absorbing capacity of deferred taxes either. And we assume all our assets are going to earn the risk-free rate, whatever that means. But let's assume we understand what risk-free rate means. Probably we assume we define it in the same way that the Solvency II does. I'm going to assume that there's no eligibility restrictions or no funnies on the balance sheet, so no sub-debt or things that might restrict the eligibility of own funds, that the actual economic value of the own funds are available and eligible to cover the SCR. So we come up with this. Our S2AV, Solvency II appraisal value, which we defined before as a net present value of distributable profits, valued at the shareholders' required rate of return, which we'll define in a moment, is equal to the initial own funds plus the initial risk margin minus the cost of capital of holding the SCR and the risk margin. And we're going to prove that in a moment, but just accept that for now. And the cost of capitals are all, again, based on the shareholders' required rates of return, which we're going to define. According to that clock, it's about 4:10 at the moment, so we've only got 2 hours and 50 minutes to go, so plenty of time, I think. Okay, so we're going to make a further sweeping assumption at this stage, and we're going to say, let's say the shareholders' required rate of return, so it's equivalent to the discount rate we're going to use to discount our distributable profits, is the risk-free rate defined under Solvency II plus 6%, remembering that 6% is the cost of capital that is prescribed for the calculation of the risk margin, and remembering that the risk margin will reflect exactly the same risks as the SCR, because we're taking no hedgeable risks at this stage. We can then show that if that's the case, then the cost of capital for holding the SCR and the risk margin is equal to the initial risk margin. And so we end up with this. Now, this lady, who's called Beryl, she's very, very surprised at this result. I think it is a very elegant result that under these circumstances, I know we've made a huge number of big assumptions here, that our S2AV actually equals our initial own funds. And I think that's it is quite a satisfying result. Probably not the most beautiful of all mathematical equations, but we're quite happy with it. And Beryl was delighted with this result. And we can use it as a starting point for our valuation. So we're going to say, when we do our S2AV, we're going to start, our first stab at the valuation is that the value is equal to the initial own funds. And that's where we're going to start, and then we're going to build on that. Okay, so we are going to try and work through and try and prove this in a moment. But if we just have a look at how these distributable profits might arise in our projection that we have, I think there's two ways of looking at it. One, which is in the left-hand graph, is we'll assume we've got annual steps, and it's 20-year to project out the business that's in force on the books. So at each year end, we've got our own funds before any distribution of dividends. We've got our SCR, remember we're just holding the capital held is just the standard formula SCR at this stage. And then the amount you can distribute is the difference between the two. So it's the grey bar. Hopefully you can, it's a bit, I can't see with these glasses on at all, but yeah, I think it's reasonably clear out there. So the smaller bar on the left-hand graph, those are the distributable profits, difference between the blue one and the orange one. Another way of looking at it is to look at the right-hand graph and say, well, okay, right at the start, let's assume we've got some excess of own funds over our SCR, which is the big blue bar at time naught on the right-hand graph. And we will say, well, let's assume we can distribute that out straight away. That's excess capital, which we're not going to hold back at this stage. And then going forward, because we're assuming our liabilities and assets are matched, our BEL and our best estimate liabilities and the assets backing them will kind of move forward together. So there's no surplus or loss being generated as you move forward on those. So the things actually change the own funds from one period to the next are going to be the interest on own funds, the interest on the risk margin, and then the release of our SCR and the release of a risk margin going forward. And we can show that under our big set of starting assumptions that we made, the net present value of those equals the starting own funds. Okay, well, roll your sleeves up, everybody. So here it comes. All right, so I know, Martin, this is a bit you were looking for. Well, we thought it would make us look clever if we put some algebra on the board, so that's why we've done that. And I'll try and briefly go through it, but there's not a test after this or anything like that. So, trying to do this algebraically, our distributable profit at time t years for t greater than or equal to 1 and I is our risk-free rate. Okay, we can see it's the first thing. I'll see if I'm going to point this assassin's kind of red dot. Doesn't seem to be working. No, not getting much out of that. Upside down. No, okay, well, it's the first line anyway. Okay, so we can see that in this first line, we're basically saying it's the change in SCR because our own funds are going to be equal to the SCR. And the change of risk margin, or the release of risk margin, the release of SCR, and the interest thereon. So that's the first row in our slide. Okay, so if we then want to work out what the net present value of all that lot is, and we're going to assume our business runs off over N years, we then get the second line. So it's our initial surplus, own funds at time naught minus SCR at time naught, plus a couple of summed things. So that's the sum of the thing above for T equals 1 up to N. Okay, we can then rearrange that into the next line, which I did have to remind myself how I did this a couple of days ago, and it does still work, I think. Rearrange it into the next line, and then into the next line, the one that's the second up from the bottom, we can cancel a couple of terms, so minus SCR naught and plus SCR naught. Then we end up with own funds at time naught, risk margin at time naught, plus this last bit, which is the second one up from the bottom, that starts I minus IDR, and then plus a sum thing, which is in discounting. Now, that is the cost of holding the risk margin and the SCR, because we would say that we're going to earn the risk-free rate I on our assets. We want to earn the risk discount rate on our own funds or on our SCR and on our risk margin. So our cost each year is that I minus RDR times the thing in the sum, and then those are all discounted at the risk discount rate. So the last bit of it is kind of our cost of risk margin and SCR after time naught. And the various things cancel out, and we end up with own funds at start plus risk margin at start minus the cost of capital of holding the risk margin and the SCR. So hopefully you're confused now, yes. But believe me, this does work. Okay, so we've got this, and this is where we started, but then we need to try and do something else with this. We want to show that our risk margin at time naught equals our cost of capital for holding the SCR and the risk margin. So we get something else. So we're going to now make an assumption, which is our last bit of the puzzle. We're going to assume our risk discount rate is the risk-free rate plus 6%. And we're going to write cost of capital total as to be the cost of capital of SCR risk margin. And it equals, again, it's I minus RDR and then plus this thing that's summed. And then we can rearrange that very slightly because we know discount rate is I plus 6%. And we get this thing at the end of the first row, 6% times the thing in the sum. And we define our risk margin according to the second line, which is a sum of a number of SCRs. Remember, we've only got non-hedgeable risks at the moment, so our SCRs are the same as those that are underlying the risk margin, and we can basically discount a load of SCRs times the 6% cost of capital and discount them this time at the risk-free rate. So that is how that is. So our cost of capital total is then, we're going to write that it equals 6% times the sum of a big function. And this is quite difficult. Was quite difficult to write on the board, but again, you can work the algebra out. If you collect terms which involve SCR naught and then the terms which involve SCR 1, you do find that this actually works. The total cost of capital is 6% times the sum of this function, where this function is defined at the end. So I'm not going to show that on the board, but it does work. So our function can also be written as the first row in this thing, and this is the sort of the bit which is I thought was quite clever actually. End of the previous slide, the thing which is summed in brackets. It looks like the net present value of a stream of cash flows, where those cash flows have a particular value, a particular interest rate. So it's a net present value of a stream of cash flows of 1. where the values and interest rate of J, where J equals 6% over 1 plus I, believe it or not, because 1 plus J equals 1 plus I plus 6% divided by 1 plus I. So we can re-express the function as the top row. So it's a net present value. The thing in the sum is a net present value, really, and we can re-express that using our usual kind of net present value type of formulae. So our function is then this thing in the top row, which we can then simplify down a bit more, and we cancel a few things out with one another, and so on, and then we can work all the way down, and we end up with the thing just before it says hence. So our function is SCR time t times 1 over 1 plus I to t plus 1. So going all the way back to when we said, I know this is a bit of a marathon, but where we said our cost of capital total was 6% times the sum of these functions, we now know that this function is equal to SCR times 1 over 1 plus I to the t plus 1. So our cost of capital total is then the thing in the last but one row, is 6% times the thing in the sum, which actually is our risk margin at the start. So it's just like magic, really. So we eventually end up, the cost of capital in this case is equal to our starting risk margin, which means our S2AV, our net present value of all of our distributable profits, is equal to our starting own funds. I said, well, that's all very clever. Right, but what does it mean? What does it help us to do? Well, we can move on from there then and start introducing things that make this scenario a bit more realistic. So we can start putting things that, obviously, we're going to have tax. So we'll make a bit of a sweeping assumption that our taxable basis is equal to our Solvency II basis. So our kind of, if you like, reserves for Solvency II purposes is equal to our technical provisions. I think even if that's not the case, we kind of think things probably come out in the wash, more or less, with DTAs and DTLs and so on. Clearly, we're not going to be running an insurance company on 100% of SCR, so we're assuming there's a target solvency ratio of TSR, some percentage of SCR, 150% or something like that. And our shareholders' required rate of return is going to be something other than risk-free plus 6%. So we can generalise out our expression of S2AV to be still net present value of distributable profits, but it's now the starting own funds plus risk margin netted down for tax minus our cost of capital for SCR and our cost of capital for risk margin. I mean, it does start to get a little bit more messy now because this, again, with tax movements in your SCR are not going to be taxable, they're just capital movements. Movements in your risk margin, we assume, are taxable because it's part of the technical provisions. And there's a few other things. SCR may allow for loss absorbing capacity of deferred taxes, a risk margin doesn't, and so on. So there's a little bit more to do now if we start bringing these things in to do our calculation. But we may be able to have some things to help. I mean, if we have a risk margin calculation from the company we're looking to buy, for instance, that should hopefully give us some projection of SCRs, and this is going to help us to work out our cost of capital that we can use in our calculation. So we've generalised out this a little bit. The next thing is we're going to say, what happens if we do take hedgeable risks, or rather we don't hedge risks which are hedgeable? And we could argue, well, why? You're only going to take hedgeable risks that you could theoretically hedge if there's going to be some reason to do it. And we think really is because that the increased risks are more than compensated by increased returns. Otherwise, why would you bother doing it? And a market consistent type framework, it doesn't really make any sense to take hedgeable risks. But in our framework, it potentially does. And we're thinking about offsetting our increased returns on, like, risky assets against any capital charge we might incur by holding those assets. And any type of decision we'd make would depend on the shareholders or the insurer's risk appetite and their preferences and any constraints on types of risks and their own assessment of their risks and returns, which could time with the ORSA process. Again, taking quite a general view of this and assuming it's a non-participating business for a moment, the impact on our valuation of investing in risky assets might be something like the net present value of total risky assets. So we'll, how much risky asset have we got at the start of each year, discount that back at our risk discount rate, times the extra returns we can get for those on those risky assets above risk-free, minus a capital charge for those. And if we want to make a starting point, we could assume that our uplift, our real-world uplift, or our extra return from our taking hedgeable risks and our capital charge are a dramatic constant proportion of risky assets, and that's going to be our starting point for doing this calculation. So we get the expression at the bottom where we say it's a net present value of total risky assets times the thing in the curly brackets, so excess returns above risk-free times 1 month's tax rate minus something which is really the cost of capital discount rate, RDR minus what you earn on the assets, risk-free net of tax, times the additional capital required on those assets times your TSR, remember, is the target solvency ratio. Okay. So, in a sense, this is things are starting to get more complicated, but when Ed comes onto his part, we'll actually look at some of the ways you could potentially do this in practice in a real, even in an M&A scenario where where information is quite limited. But we think this is quite a key point. By allowing value to be created or destroyed by taking hedgeable risks or holding risky assets, we've really moved away from a strict market consistent methodology. Under an MCV type view, why would you take these kind of risks? You don't get any additional return because you're going to say any additional return is cancelled by additional risk. And these kind of measures don't really reflect a proper capital charge for taking those risks, except something like frictional costs and MCEV, which is a very, very small component. Whereas our methodology, we believe, does reflect an investor's view of additional return from taking hedgeable risks, and with a risk which is reflected through a capital requirement based on their, you know, what they see as a capital requirement, some percentage of SCR, and their required return on that capital. So we do think it does provide quite a good framework for, you know, making decisions to do these types of things, to take these extra risks. Now, we can then refine some of our assumptions that we made, that excess returns and additional capital remain constant proportions of risky assets. We can refine this. It may not be reasonable in some cases, such as, you know, corporate bond spread risk. You might determine that that's going to run off over time as those bonds run off, particularly in a closed book. Additional capital may change over time as the mix of guarantees changes or diversification benefit with other blocks of business and things like that. And we can allow for these with different differing degrees of sophistication. Now, I'm not really that familiar with SpongeBob's, with Mr. Pants' work, SpongeBob SquarePants. I suppose some people might have children, or some people who are perhaps older kids themselves might know who this is. I understand there's a theme song sung by the pirate where he's described as absorbent and yellow and porous as he. And so it's just reminded of the importance of loss-absorbing capacity off technical provisions and deferred taxes, which I'm sure is what the pirate had in mind. If we move on to participating business, things do get a bit more complicated, because we now say, well, if we make additional returns on our assets back in liabilities, potentially some of these will go to policyholders through additional bonuses or profit sharing. I mean, Ed and I tend to work in continental European markets where often these things, policyholder profit sharing, is often formula driven rather than perhaps the kind of UK with profits concepts of bonuses being smoothed and so on. But nonetheless, I think the same principle would apply. So we bring in participating business. We have to allow for, well, some of these uplifts on risky assets are going to go to policyholders. We're going to now bring in loss-absorbing capacity of technical provisions, as potentially some of our SCR shocks can be absorbed at least partially by policyholders. And, of course, we get our old favourite, trying to allow for financial options and guarantees. So if we do assume a continental-type profit-sharing business, so typically formula driven based on, say, book value returns with an interest guarantee and either a fixed margin or some margin and a percentage of investment returns, we can say our increasing value due to investing in risky assets becomes the formula shown. So it's excess returns on risky assets times portion going to shareholders, netted down for tax, and then minus the cost of capital times additional capital with an allowance for loss absorbing capacity, which is our last point, LAC TP, which we're expressing as a percentage of that additional capital for now. And clearly things do get more messy when you get into participating business and you know, perhaps becomes less clear which risks are actually hedgeable when you start getting dynamic lapses and things like that. So very quickly, as I got to get overrun by the time, we have done, I mean, there's various worked examples in the first of our papers which illustrate some of these things, and you get some quite interesting results coming out. I mean, in an example that we've got, a very simple premium example and various assumptions that we've made, we looked at how if we invest 50% of our assets in risky assets with a particular assumed real-world uplift or excess returns and a particular SCR shock, we can see from the graph, as our underlying guarantee rate increases, we find the shareholders' proportion of additional returns goes up, which is a bit of a second order effect in a partly because some of the assets are actually not backing the policyholder liabilities, they're backing the additional capital. So there are some second order effects in there as well. But what you find is the higher the guarantee, the more in the money the guarantees are, and the more you gain from investing in risky assets from that point of view, because your additional returns goes straight to the shareholders to try and help them cover the cost of the guarantees. When your guarantees are out of the money, then potentially, in our scenario, 80% goes to the policyholders. And those are the blue bars. On the grey bars, our ability to absorb losses decreases as our guarantee rate goes up. So as our guarantees come more into the money, ability to pass losses on to policyholders diminishes because our guarantees are in the money. So when we finally get to a 2% in this example guarantee rate, there's no loss absorbing capacity at all. And we actually find that our impact to investing in risky assets is least at the guarantee rate of 2%. We have these two offsetting features. And then just finally, if we then fix the guarantee at 1%, and then we look at what is the value from investing more in risky assets, we find that actually in this example peaks out at about 20%, because our shareholders' share of additional returns for investing in those risky assets increases very modestly, really, because it's really just the fact you've got some additional capital you're required to hold. Your SCR market goes up as you hold more risky assets, and that part of the capital, that part of the assets, all the additional return will go to shareholders because it's not backing policyholder liabilities. Whereas our LAC TP, our ability to absorb any losses due to our SCR market shocks, diminishes as those SCR market shocks become bigger as we hold more and more risky assets. So in this case, our optimal, if we like, amount of risky assets to hold would be 20%. So there's plenty of worked examples in our paper. But just quickly going on, and I'll hand over to Ed in a moment. If we then compare, Mark Twain says, comparison is the death of joy, but never mind, we're trying to quell your joy a little by a quick bit of comparison with other valuation methods. I mean, our S2AV is a bit similar to the old school traditional embedded value that I did when I was a lad, before any of this market consistent stuff came along, where we not had statutory profits and Solvency I minimum solvency margin discount at the risk discount rate. They were the good old days. So it's quite similar to that, really, just replacing statutory accounting with Solvency II technical provisions and required capital based on SCR rather than a kind of Solvency I type solvency margin. And it's very important not to try and mix the two things up, not to try and do a Solvency II type capital with an old school kind of statutory reserving methodology. And our S2AV is similar to a forward-looking perspective under the ORSA, but there are some. I mean, ORSA doesn't. It's not really about valuation. It doesn't really talk about cost of capital, which our method does try to itemise out. But nonetheless, the author can be quite an important source of information. At least you need to try to work out how it might extend out beyond the 3 to 5 years. And very quickly, I mean, as we said, we do depart from marking consistency with our method, because we allow for real-world investment returns, we allow for cost of market risks. If we think of MCEV and Solvency II, they don't really place any cost on capital for market risks. They don't. Obviously, there is a capital calculated, but it doesn't really come through as a cost of capital. There's a cost of capital for non-hedgeable risks in the risk margin, or the cost of residual non-hedgeable risks under the MCEV, but it doesn't really allow for proper cost of capital for taking hedgeable risks. And MCEV, they're not really forward-looking projections. The only reason you do a projection under MCEV is to try and value the liabilities on a market-consistent way, whereas ours methodology does consider a forward-looking view of real-world returns and when profits can be distributed. And there are other differences. MCEV is only really for life business, covered business, whereas our method covers all types of insurance. And proper differences between MCEV and Solvency II are probably diminishing now, although MCEV is probably on its way out anyway. So the last point may be less important, but we still think there are a number of very key differences to market consistent type valuation methods. I'm going to hand over to Ed now.
Right, the bad news is we're only halfway through the slides, but the good news is there's no algebra in the remaining part, so I gave Jeremy all the difficult bits, so it's in terms of mental effort, most of the work's done. We put this slide in because Jeremy likes the works of Only Fools and Horses, and I'm interested in Warren Buffett, so this is, tells you something about us. I mean, we've explained quite a lot about the theoretical background. Where we really use this in practice was in real M&A situations, first of all, and also in some decisions around product pricing, ALM, and similar issues. In real situations, I mean, the reason we developed this methodology is we found a number of, we were working for a number of clients who were interested in a view based on what distributable profits would look like, and they wanted to, you know, they were faced with all the challenges of the complexity of the Solvency II system, and they wanted a way to get through that to the value. And we actually saw often there was quite sort of broad brush assumptions made, which we weren't always convinced were really giving them a true picture of the value. And we thought the theoretical methodology is quite helpful in getting to that. But there are also lots of practical constraints which need to be thought about in a real situation, like other limits on dividends, formal or informal. Some European regulators are specifying that dividends can only be based on statutory profits or a percentage of statutory profits. IFRS might change that. IFRS 17 might change that. But I think there's quite a lot still to play out on that and how that will affect the distributable profit picture. There might be various other constraints like shareholder agreements, non-liquid assets. There's also, as Solvency II went into place, there's various sort of complications and nuances that came in that can affect some of this, rules on eligibility and tiering, ring fence funds, group requirements, things like internal models can complicate things. But nonetheless, we still believe the method is very useful, and Solvency II and Solvency II excess available capital will be the primary driver of distributable profits. And when you have these other considerations, most likely to arrive at the right answer by starting to look at a methodology based around Solvency II picture and then adjusting it for these other considerations rather than making the other considerations the core of the process. So, as I said, we first applied this methodology in a number of different M&A situations, and we, as Jeremy's explained, we can break down the components of value into a number of different factors, which are quite useful because often, even at early stages of an M&A process where we might have limited information, we might even have only public information about a company, we can still get a good idea of these different different components. And they're also, the different components tend to be things that are driven by different aspects of value generation in that company. So to get the own funds, that's usually available information as a Solvency II balance sheet. Probably most of the information for that is available in something like SFCR's public Solvency II reporting. Cost of capital for non-hedgeable risks, that can be fairly easy to find. Basically, could be based off a risk margin calculation if that's done. Sometimes risk margin calculations are done at varying degrees of sophistication, but it's a good starting point. For the impact of hedgeable risks, we need to, as Jeremy said, it probably depends a bit on what types of risks we've got, but basically the drivers will be the volume of expected future assets in each future year, the uplift we'll get from the taking market risk from those assets and the capital requirement associated with it. And we can find actually that's quite useful to work out those two things together, so have sort of real-world uplift, less cost of capital, and then apply that difference to the quantum of assets in each future period. And by keeping that consistency, we probably have a realistic view of the total effect of investing in risky assets. And finally, we've got the franchise value, which is the value of future new business, which, again, is a sort of familiar concept from most valuation methodologies and can be applied in the same sort of way. And some of the particular issues around new business I'll talk about in a few slides' time. These calculations might seem complex, and certainly if you looked at some of Jeremy's algebra, it might look very complex, but of course these things are much easier when done in Excel than they are when done in algebra. But a lot of the basic numbers can be found from typical Solvency II calculations like that of own funds, risk margin, and so on. And generally, these are calculations that can be done at varying degrees of sophistication, so you can typically start with a fairly broad brush but reasonable approach and then increase refinement. So, for example, if we're trying to look at the cost of capital associated with holding the SCR, we might start off with the total SCR for life underwriting risk, for example, and then just project that forward in proportion to a overall driver like the Bell or something like that, and then we might decide if that's material. We might want to sort of decompose that into different bits and decide actually using a driver for the whole thing isn't realistic because maybe, say, lapse risk won't develop in a uniform way over time. So there's various things we can do to sort of start from a basic calculation and then gradually refine it. That's obviously very useful in something like an M&A process where typically somebody looking at a potential acquisition wants to gradually move steps further towards getting confident about the value as the process goes forward. Projections we often find available in a sort of real-life M&A situation are not necessarily very helpful for it. Often there's sort of business plan-type projections going out for a few years. There might be market-consistent calculations underlying an MCV or something like that going out further or underlying, indeed, the Bell calculation. Things like ORSA calculations, if done well, can be quite helpful, but they, again, only have a view over a few years' time. And we found it quite helpful to be able to look at these sort of two different views, one projecting everything out to extinction of the portfolio and the other taking a cost of capital view. And the cost of capital view sort of takes advantage of the fact that the own funds is based on already discounted liability values, and that we can associate a cost of capital with the delay of in release of that surplus due to risk capital. There typically can be lots of sort of devil in the detail, small issues in a real situation. We might want to ask ourselves, are we happy with the risk allowance that the standard formula has? It doesn't allow for all risks in a reasonable way. You might take the view that it overestimates some risks. It ignores other risks. Sovereign default is a well-known one. You've also got various complications to the Solvency II methodology coming from things like transitional measures. We might want to look at the degree of simplicity and potential prudence in the calculations. For example, risk margin calculations allow to use various hierarchy of methodologies, some of which are more precise and some of which are less precise, and some of which may give some prudence. Tax is often a complicated issue. We might have sometimes material deferred tax assets or liabilities which need to be thought about. And things like alternatives to the standard formula, like internal models, partial internal models, undertaking specific parameters, they can all be important issues to consider for certain companies. So as Jeremy said, we wrote two papers about this. The first one was about M&A context and valuation of total companies, but we've also been working with clients to apply this in the field of new business value and profitability, because the same types of decision-making framework are equally useful when making decisions about how we price products and various associated questions and decisions. This is another quote. We wanted a quote for each section. I wasn't so convinced about this one, but Jeremy said it was the student society and we needed to do something for the young people, although I think Moby's been around for a little while, but still quite young for us. But he said there should be emotional criteria for evaluating work instead of profitability. I'm not quite sure what the analogy to our work is, but there you go. So in the S2 NBV, this is really a parallel application of the same methodology. Instead of looking at total company value, we're looking at the value of new business. I'm pleased to say, as I anticipated before, I'm not going to go through all the same algebra, but similar algebra would apply. A key difference in practice is that we're very much looking on a marginal view, and that's quite critical. If we're looking at sort of an old-style, traditionally embedded value type of view of capital and value, we tend to be able to sort of look at new business and look at the in-force business and just add them together, more or less. I mean, there can be some complications to that, but generally there's not too many. Under Solvency II, we can't do that because the marginal value of adding a block of new business onto an existing business will depend on the interaction of the assets and liabilities on the existing and the new business, and the interaction of risks on the existing and new business. We'll have some illustrations of that, but most obviously, if for example, we're writing new business that is very different in its characteristics from the existing business, then there'll be a diversification benefit, and the marginal cost of capital from that new business will be less than the standalone cost of capital of a new company setting up and starting to sell the same business. Again, we're taking a real-world view, and again, it allows appropriate assessment of various different management decisions that need to be made during this process. As I mentioned, the marginal impact of writing new business, it has an impact on diversification benefit with existing business, so it can have a capital impact. It can also have an impact for certain types of business on the ALM position. If you have a pooled fund, for example, Jeremy mentioned that we're working a lot in continental Europe. We often have sort of asset pools that are used for existing and new business, and bringing new money for new business can affect the value of the existing and the new business, so you have to really consider the total marginal ALM impact. New business will often affect the tax position because it may be changing the timing of taxable profits or the ability to recover deferred tax liabilities, deferred tax assets. And of course, it can have an expense effect because adding new business will help to spread expenses. So when you add all of these things together, we arrive at the view that just looking at new business from a standalone view, having an actuary who's in one part of the insurance company who can calculate new business value without talking to the valuation actuaries in another part of the building doesn't work anymore. We need to think about the two things together, and we need to consider the marginal impact. So I'm not going to run through all of these formulae, but essentially the concept is the same for the what we call the S2NBV as it was for the S2AV. So it's the initial own funds, so the own funds added by the new business, less the cost of capital from the non-hedgeable risks, and plus the impact of taking hedgeable risks, i.e., the real-world uplift we might expect to get on the returns on assets, less the cost of the additional capital. And we can, you know, do analogous things to what we would do in an embedded value methodology, like defining a margin based on the present value of new business premiums and so on. Now, having defined this methodology, it's it can be quite usefully applied into product design and risk management, and I think that's, you know, that should be one of the benefits of Solvency II, that because it's based on a economic view of value and a risk-based view of capital, you should be able to get benefits from in terms of improved management of companies, because both the value and the capital side of the equation are realistic in some way. And that means that when you look at product design, you can look at various things like how does, for say, a product with an embedded guarantee, how does the design of that guarantee affect value? If I have a more onerous guarantee, if I give an option under, say, a stochastic view or under stresses that you might be doing for the SCR, that might have an effect. What benefit do I get from reinsurance? What benefit do I get from asset liability management? How do I consider potential future management actions, policyholder behavior? What's the impact of the assumed volume of new business? If I have a small volume of new business, the marginal impact of that business on the existing book might be quite different than if I have a large volume of new business. In fact, in practice, we can see that a lot of decisions that might be taken in insurance companies and sort of taken on sort of isolated view of looking at that particular issue can be all brought together in a holistic view with this type of methodology to look at things. Now we're going to give a sort of simple example based on a simple participating product. Basically, we have similar type of design to the one that Jeremy was showing before, with a profit-sharing formula based on book value investment returns subject to a minimum guarantee. And then what we've done in this example, which is set out in more detail in the paper we've written, which Jeremy referred to, is we looked at a base product design, and then we looked at a number of alternative product designs, and seeing how the different elements of the value vary across those different product designs shows how the metric can be used to make decisions about product pricing, risk mitigation and related issues. So in the interest of time, I won't run through all of these, but we've got differences like different levels of minimum guarantee, products allowing, passing 100% of excess investment returns above a fixed margin onto the policyholders versus ones that retain a profit-sharing proportion for the shareholders, and products with features affecting liquidity of the product, like market value adjusters on surrender, or allowing bonuses to go negative so that we don't lock in bonuses, consolidate them every year. And so if we run those examples against the components of value we had, we can see how they vary them. Now, these sets of examples suffer a bit from the low interest rate, because it means that if you've got a lot of high interest rates and guarantees that are quite a long way below it, then expected future profit participation becomes an important element of the value, and you start to have lots of things happening about loss absorbing capacity of technical provisions. It's because we use sort of realistic-ish economic conditions, not all of those things happen in quite the same way, but it's we do get some interesting effects. So across these different, so the sort of five sets of bars are the five different product designs, the base one and four alternative product designs. So this might be a product design exercise where we're working with the marketing department and other parts of the insurance company to make decisions about how to design products. In the base case, we've got a higher guarantee, and we can see that on the no market risk view, that doesn't really change things if we compare the base case with case A. But when we look at the other components of value, which is the cost of the market SCR, the real world uplift, the impact of time value of financial options and guarantees to give us the total S2 NBV margin, we can see that the different product designs start to have an effect. So, for example, if we compare the base with case A, we see that by reducing the minimum guarantee, we get a significant benefit in terms of reduced time value of options and guarantees, and indeed also a reduced market SCR. Because of the product designs, we don't get a lot of real-world uplift in either of these cases, so it's basically just a benefit comparing product design A with the base case. In product design B, we have a profit-sharing feature, so that leads to some real-world uplift. But overall, the dark blue bar with the total Solvency II profit margin is lower. And we can see that, for example, the designs with different levels of liquidity have some benefit on different parts of the value composition. One part of that is the loss-absorbing capacity of technical provisions. So by reducing the minimum the amount we're guaranteeing, we might have the same central expected policyholder return, but more of its profit participation, less of its guaranteed, and so we're able to absorb market shocks through loss-absorbing capacity of technical provision. Hence, you can see a key difference between the base value and product design A is increased loss-absorbing capacity of technical provisions. In the interest of time, just to run through these very quickly, here we show the impact of different marginal situations, i.e. we're writing the same block of new business with the same product design and the same risk characteristics, but our existing business of the company we're writing it onto is different. So we can compare the standalone value with the marginal value for a similar in-force block, where the in-force block is similar to the new business block, and the Solvency II new business margin doesn't change very much. But if we have a small and dissimilar light in-force block, then the margin starts to go up. And if we have a large and dissimilar block, the margin goes up even more. And, of course, that's coming basically due to increased diversification benefit, because if we're writing a new business block onto an in-force block that looks the same, the diversification benefit is not material. So this is illustrated here. You can see the blue bar is the some of the submodules, and the orange bar below the line is the diversification benefit, which increases with the more diversification we have, comparing the existing and the new business. I'll pass this one in the interest of time. And in fact, this one as well, and because I'd like to just spend a little bit of time on a non-life example. We've applied the same methodology to non-life business, which is quite interesting, because non-life valuation metrics are often quite different from the ones used in life insurance. People are still looking at things like target combined ratios and calculating return on capital in more simplified metrics. In this example, we're just comparing two blocks of non-life business, a sort of motor other, so not MTPL, but other motor, with general third-party liability. We're assuming no market risk is taken. We're assuming the same combined ratio for both of these blocks of business, and the only difference is in the payment pattern. So we can see the GTPL block has a slower payment pattern. This is cumulative payout, so it takes nearly 11 years to be all paid, and the motor other is paid much more quickly. This is actually based on a sort of a real example, so this is a realistic payment pattern. What we get here is that the motor other, because of the slower payment pattern, the faster payment pattern, has a significantly higher new business margin than the GTPL, which has a 0% new business margin, remember, for the same combined ratio. And if you mix the two business lines, so you're writing 50% of one and 50% of the other, you get something that's higher than the average of the two, and the reason for that is the diversification benefit on the non-life underwriting risks. So it's quite informative to just see why those value differences occur. So this is the first bar shows the difference due to the starting own funds, so the discounted value of the future profits, essentially. And on that basis, the GTPL, which is the long tail business in this case, is actually better, because you have more discounting on the liabilities, so the actual discounted value of the liabilities is lower, and the starting own funds is higher. But when we allow for cost of capital factors, the benefit of lower cost of capital for the motor other business more than outweighs the increased discounting, and that comes from two different factors. One is that you have to hold the capital for much longer because of the reserving risk capital requirement. And the other is that the actual standard formula has a higher capital factor, reflecting the higher degree of historic variability in the GTPL class. And we can also look at the effect of layering market risk onto that, and we get the same type of possibility to optimise the level of market risk that Jeremy showed in the life in force example before. So in the interest of time, I'm going to wrap up and just make a few concluding comments. I think you must unlearn what you've learned. I'm not sure about that's quite true, because you've always got to build what you learn onto what you've learned before. But I do think that Solvency II throws up some new challenges and necessitates some new way of looking at things. So you must at least revisit what you've learned before. The sort of key to this methodology is that we can look at a view of real-world distributable profits, and we can get to that by looking at own funds plus a cost of capital, and we can look separately at the value before we consider hedgeable market risks, and then look at the value impact of adding those risks on, and that is quite helpful in terms of decomposing the different insurance activities. So if we go back to the non-life example, we worked with a client who said we want to convert our combined operating ratio targets we've been using to price products into a return on capital metrics, but we want to focus only on underwriting risk because the guys who are being set these targets are making underwriting risk, and a different set of people in the company are being set investment targets, and if they can add something from the investment side as well, that's good, but we don't want to target the same people. We want the underwriting people to make a return on capital on underwriting. We want the investment people to make a return on capital on the asset management activities. So by decomposing, we're able to allow for those different factors. Although the context is quite different, there might be different users of these standards, the S2NBV standard and the S2AV standard are sort of the same framework and the same algebra, so the one that Jeremy talked through. I think in the interest of time, I'll probably close there so that we have a bit of time for questions.
Yeah, just before we start questions, we've changed slightly in that we do value all your opinions, so there is a bottle of champagne on offer for the best contribution to the discussion by a student member of the IFOA and also by a fellow of the IFOA, regardless of your years post-qualification. Please clearly state your name and which of these categories you fall into before asking a question. You can now raise your hand. Bottle of Moe sounds quite good. Right, we've got the guy in the front over here, you mean?
Alan White, a fellow member. Thanks very much, guys. I was able to follow it quite well, having cut my teeth on traditional embedded value. One thing that you did speak about financial options and guarantees, but I got the impression that the method's quite deterministic, and I'm just wondering if there's a risk that doing things this way underestimates the value of options and guarantees. You know, if you don't do something more stochastic, perhaps you could say something about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think we didn't spend a lot of time talking about it, but in the first step, when we're looking at the own funds, clearly the own funds should be valued on a stochastic basis, so under Solvency II standards. So we've captured at the beginning the time value of options and guarantees, and that's quite critical. I mean, and I think it's slightly torturous, but as Jeremy said, the thinking behind the algebra is to say we have those options and guarantees at the beginning, but we decide to hedge them. For sort of valuation purposes, and then we take away the hedging and we see the impact on value. So I think in terms of sort of time zero value, that all drops out. In terms of how that projects forward, it's a bit more complicated, and because, you know, you've got to consider what is the impact of a real world view on future economic balance sheets and future time value of options and guarantees. But I think in terms of time zero value, it sort of should work, and it all sort of drops out in the wash, really. But it's certainly a valid point, and it's an important one, because of course, if we're going to sort of discounting liabilities on a risk free rate when those rates are very low, we can't forget about the options and guarantees, which can be material.
Thank you.
We've got a question over here in the front.
Yeah. So in practice, you've used this methodology. How close has it got to a value that has actually been paid in the market? That's the first part of it. And also, just have values gone up or down as a result of Solvency II? Or you just don't know? I'm just interested.
I think it's very hard to tell whether values have gone up and down because of Solvency II, because there's just so much sort of white noise of other things going on, because, of course, Solvency II has come in at the same time as interest rates going very low in the Eurozone and in other places. So I think it is hard to tell. I think what this type of approach probably does allow to do, and it's a sort of partial answer to the first part of your question, is that I think whereas before we saw buyers, certainly for certain types of companies, saying we've got the MCEV, but we don't really think, we think the MCEV overvalues the company, and you know, that was reflected in probably market caps of companies and in a lot of transaction prices. I think with this, you tend to be able to rationalise why the MCEV may overestimate the value of the company, because you can see, particularly in terms of cost of capital, that this, you know, it can be more expensive because you're targeting not 100% of the capital but more, and you're looking at the cost of capital for all risks. So I think it allows to rationalise back to a value that makes more sense to people. We typically in transactions we've used this. There's been a sort of parallel approach with sort of investment bankers doing more simplistic approaches, which sort of have the same underlying thinking behind them, because they're still trying to project future distributable profits, but they may just go out a few years and then take a terminal value and apply a multiplier to it or something. But if it's done in a consistent way, it will give a similar value, and the value for most types of, it will depend on the risk discount rate and things like that. The value is pretty sensitive to the risk discount rate and the assumed level of capitalisation, but if the risk discount rate is a bit higher and the assumed level of capitalisation is 150 or something, then you'll typically get something that's less than the MCEV.
We had a question at the back there, okay. And then after that we can go to this gentleman in front.
I have a question regarding the new business value part. So in your calculation, you use a marginal capital requirement for new business. To me, I'm just thinking it's kind of like using the marginal expenses to calculate new business value. I was just thinking, is that really sustainable if we price and use marginal capital requirements rather than kind of re-spread the capital between the in-force business and new business? Just as we did for the expense, so we don't use marginal expense. We spread overhead expense to new business as well.
Well, I think we have to take all these things together. I mean, typically you can do. I think one of the key things is a diversification benefit with the in-force block, as we showed in one of the examples. I mean, if you're writing new business of a particular type, and it's quite different to your in-force block, you're going to get a capital benefit from doing that, because the capital amounts are diversified against each other. So I think it is quite difficult. Some of these calculations are quite hard to actually kind of run models with and without the new business and so on. But I think if you just run things on their own, standalone, you do miss a component of this. I don't think it's much about spreading capital. I think it's more about getting benefit of writing dissimilar blocks of business against each other. Because you might decide, well, I've got a lot of this type of business. If I carry on writing the same type of business, it's worth less to me than if I write something different. And a similar type of thing you get if you're in an M&A transaction, well, my existing company has this type of business, I'm going to buy something with a completely different type of business, and actually it's worth more to me than the seller than it is to the seller. So, I mean, clearly you need to be careful, and I think with the, it's perhaps different to the idea of just spreading expenses, where you're looking at what is your expense base and how many policies are you spreading that over. I think it's more about different types of business and diversification benefit you might get, and things like ALM benefits that you might get from writing one type of business and putting in new business with it.
Maybe just to add one more comment to give an example of what Jeremy's saying. I mean, I don't think it necessarily needs to be different types of business. It could be that sort of product design errors were made in the past, leading to overexposure to certain types of risks, and new product designs could be fundamentally similar customer propositions but with different risks, because the risks that weren't fully appreciated in the past are appreciated now, and hence you can get offsets of risks on things like lapse risk or mortality risk, and you can design reinsurance programs that get offsets of risk. So it's about, I think, also reflecting sort of risk mitigation and management strategies into product design. And if you don't capture those sort of marginal benefits, I think you're not really aligned in your view, in your valuation view, with the way you should be thinking about risk management.
Hi, Carl Chappell, fellow. Just thinking a little bit about how your approach moves away from market consistency. I can see how you could get to the component about impact of non-hedgeable risk, thinking about the excess spread on assets maybe, and also the cost of capital associated with that component as well. I'm just thinking the risk discount rate is the bit that seems a bit trickier to me. I'm just wondering, you know, two parts is how do you help your investor clients calibrate the risk discount rate? And typically when you've seen transactions, you know, what level of risk discount rate have you used when you've been using your framework?
I mean, we often don't help them calibrate it, in the sense that often the clients already have a view about what is the target level of return on capital they want to make. So it's more about saying, you know, the question we often get asked is, if we want to make a return on capital of X, you know, how much can we pay for this company? And maybe, because Solvency II standards are quite complex and got quite a lot of moving parts, what could we do to that company? Could we de-risk it? Could we re-risk it? Could we put it together with another block? How could that affect our return on capital, rather than saying what should the return on capital be? I mean, I think usually investors will have a view on what return on capital they're trying to achieve, and they'll have a view on how much risk they're trying to take, and I think, you know, they'll have arrived at that conclusion, and then our job has usually been trying to help them apply that. I think the transactions we've seen in the last few years when we've been applying this methodology have been a very mixed bag, and you know, there's been quite a lot of sort of cleaning up transactions, troubled companies being sold, quite a lot of multinationals have sort of got rid of subscale businesses close to new business and things, and I think that they've been often transacted at quite high rates of return on capital implied by the transaction. I think that's coming down now, because there's more money available to do those transactions and there's more appetite for them. So, you know, we were seeing sort of troubled type of companies being rescued at, you know, rates of 10% or more, and now people are, you know, saying, well, actually, I'm sitting on money. If I could make 10% on it, that would be very nice. And so I think we're seeing some downward trend in those rates, but it depends a lot on the situation, of course.
Thank you.
We've got a question over here to the guy on the right.
Hi, I'm Zane Olivier, fellow. I was just wondering how your framework would cope with, I suppose, a Solvency II world, which isn't really best estimate. So if I take, for example, the matching adjustment and fundamental spread and the sort of embedded prudence on the Solvency II balance sheet from that, allowing for that properly, would you have to look at something a bit more hybrid, like the old traditional EV, and what you're proposing is it?
Yeah, I think some of the things are quite difficult to allow for. It's like allowing for transitional measures and things like that, and you might have to think, well, how do some of those things wind out? I mean, often in an M&A sort of situation, you do have limited information, and a lot of the things you do are quite high level necessarily. So you know, if you want to wind out some of those effects, you might have to do it on a fairly high level way. I mean, I haven't really thought that careful about matching adjustment particularly, because it probably doesn't really apply that much in the markets that we work in. So I'd have to think about that a bit more carefully. But I think some of these effects, and also around eligibility and some of these other things, you know, can be quite tricky to adjust for. So usually some sort of top-level adjustment on for some of these different effects. And you think you'd still start with the same framework as we've suggested, but perhaps make some adjustments to allow for some of these things. But I haven't really thought through how the matching adjustment might work.
I mean, as we said before, often we've been trying to sort of match up to a view arrived at by investment bankers, and they're probably interested in, you know, what actual amount of dividend do I think I can pay in X year's time. And so in that sense, the sort of, even though some of those transitional measures and other similar things are a departure from sort of the underlying market concerns and principles, they become a reality because they will actually influence how much dividend you can pay. So, you know, you can have people who say, actually, I want to sort of deconstruct that all and re-put it in terms of a sort of purist view on Solvency II capital. But I think it's more common that people say, well, if they're using these transitional measures on reserves, if they've got this, you know, loss of, you know, approach to calculating SCR or deferred tax assets and things like this, I want to know how that's actually going to, you know, play out in expected future dividends. So you sort of, we more often find investors who want to say, I want to see how that unwinds. So I'm happy to take credit for it now, but I want to know when the credit sort of rolls away, rather than saying I want to restate everything on more pure principles.
Before we go to any more questions from fellows, are there any students that want to ask questions? Right. Yumin, can you take it to that student over there, please?
Hi, Oliver, student. The question is around the volatility of the results. I was perhaps thinking in the context of when selecting M&A choices, is there a risk that market conditions over a long period of time, if they change, would the value change, and therefore change your selection?
I guess that is possible. And I think, you know, these kind of valuation methods, you're not really going to get a kind of point answer and say, well, this is a value you're going to pay. I'm thinking, I guess, you know, as we build up more historical Solvency II balance sheets, it might be useful to see how things move from 1 year to the next. Because I guess the other thing is that potentially the method could give you quite volatile projected dividends if you just say, well, it's going to pay out you know, the excess of own funds over SCR each year, or if there's an excess now, they're going to pay it out immediately. So I think all these things need to be borne in mind. We'll definitely see this framework as a starting point, you know, to make adjustments to, and you don't want to be, you know, capitalising something just because markets happen to have gone up very recently and they could go down again. So I think these things need to be kept in mind, and you may want to say, well, we'll assume a higher target solvency capital or something like that to allow for some of these effects.
Fellows, you back in the game? We've got a question right over there. Yeah.
Oliver Dixon, I'm a fellow. How have you thought about the framework that you've set, given that it's very, very focused around the regulations and the regulatory framework now, given that some of these things are to some extent a bit of a moving target? I mean, you focused a lot on things like the risk margin and the loss absorbing capacity of deferred taxes, both of which are things which are kind of up for discussion in terms of how those are derived at the moment. And also, you know, different players will have different capital models. The internal models could make quite a big difference to the outcome. And, you know, the future of the regulations in general at the moment. How do you think about this in terms of a decision-making process, given that it's not, we live in kind of, we're 2 years into this regulatory framework, but the thing is still not so final?
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and I think that
What we've done in practice, and I think what the methodology allows you to do quite well, is to identify the impact of things like this on value. So, for example, if we take something like loss-absorbing capacity, deferred taxes, or the risk margin definition, it's quite easy, having sort of set up the calculations, to then say we will look at alternative views, and that's something that's been done. So people, you know, will want to see sensitivity of value. So, for example, loss of absorbing capacity of deferred taxes, which can be sort of hugely material in terms of projected solvency position, can have a very material effect on dividends, because you can say, well, look, I was getting a lot of benefit, and I was expecting to pay out a nice stream of dividends. All of a sudden, I'm not expecting to pay out any dividends for a long time, and I'm even having to put capital in. So, I mean, I think that is a real uncertainty. It's not an uncertainty created by the methodology. And being able to say, well, these are the components of the methodology, allows you to directly stress those elements and look at what it's doing. I think that, you know, in terms of actual sort of M&A practitionering, it depends whether you're sort of working on the buy or the sell side. I mean, if you're working on the sell side to support an investor, then typically they will have a view on these things. They'll want to be advised about, you know, what factors might affect their view, but they will have an idea, and it doesn't matter really whether they might want to sort of try and second guess their competitors about what their view they might have on capital and things like that. If you're working on the buy side, obviously you've got to be ready for different buyers with widely different types of views, and often that comes down to, you know, saying these guys want these sensitivities run, these ones want a completely different view. So, but I think the sort of volatility and the interdependence on, regulatory changes is real. So it's not something you can get away from. And if you have a valuation standard that sort of makes that go away, I think you've lost something that is a real volatility rather than sort of getting to a more stable value.
Any more questions? Emma, if you can take it to this gentleman in the front there.
Martin White, fellow. Under your framework, how tricky is it to allow for the existence or purchase of reinsurance, and looking ahead, bearing in mind that IFRS 17 is going to complicate things?
Well, I think that reinsurance is quite easy to allow for as long as you've got good models. I mean, I think that the real challenge is how good the models you have, and as I think Jeremy referred to, we've often in real M&A situations, we often started off with quite rough and ready value and then tried to gradually refine that, because that is often a question that a potential acquirer of a company wants to know. If, you know, maybe the reinsurance arrangements that the company already has will fall away because it's group reinsurance and they need to do something different. Maybe the buyer suspects that the reinsurance arrangements may be very suboptimal, so I might be able to buy this and do something different. So being able to capture that value is important, and, you know, the Solvency II framework tells you how to allow for reinsurance in the valuation of the own funds and in various components of the SCR. So we can capture that as long as we've got good enough models to do it. In terms of IFRS 17, that's an interesting question and one that we've just started to put our minds to recently, because it's become a sort of hot topic, of course. I think our gut feeling is that, obviously, it will add complexity, but our gut feeling is that probably the main effect is it's going to accelerate profit recognition compared with statutory accounting, but it's not going to be as fast as Solvency II in terms of recognising value on the balance sheet. But probably in some sort of worked examples we've done, but it will depend a lot on the nature of the business and the case, is that it will the sort of slow down compared with own funds recognition of value on Solvency II by things like the services margin will be less than the slowdown from the drag on cost of capital under Solvency II. So you probably still get
to Solvency II being the biting dry constraint on dividend paying capacity, but that will of course depend on the view that supervisors take on what should determine when dividends could be paid. If you've got a company in runoff, for example, then you often can't sensibly just base it on profits, because you're writing down capital as well. So I think it can be an important consideration, but I think today we feel that probably Solvency II is, in most cases, will be the overriding constraint on dividend paying capacity.
Excellent, thank you. I think after a really slow start, we've done really well in terms of getting questions going. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your questions, but hopefully the speakers can stay a bit afterwards to answer some questions. In terms of the prizes, the first prize goes to Alan White over there. Thank you for getting that talk going. You can come collect it afterwards. And then the student over there who asked the question on M&A, so thank you for that. And then, despite some technical challenges, you guys did very well. So thank you, Ed and Jeremy, for your talk tonight, and let's thank them in the usual way. There are some sandwiches and drinks outside, so do come join us afterwards.
Yeah, we're happy to send them. I mean, you can find them online, but very happy to send you the links to save you a bit of Googling. I think that, it's not as simple as just... I mean, I think what we have seen in real transactions is bankers trying to do this in much too simplistic a way. Sorry. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. I mean, I remember seeing your... I think we saw your paper. We'd sort of started thinking about that and, gave us some encouragement. I think wasn't the same in all respects, but I think it was, the same message that you... It becomes... I think that's right, because I think that what we've seen is buyers not that interested in embedded value reports and saying, I just want to show me the Solvency II numbers and the business plan projection and maybe the ORSA, and that will do, and my bankers can do the work from there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's right. I mean, we have talked to. I mean, the bankers are quite interested in that. We've done a few presentations of this type of methodology to the bankers, but it's certainly important. I think that, you know, like, as consulting actuaries, to sort of, you know, get our view on the value of looking at these things properly is important. So we'll send you the links. Have a look at the papers, and happy to have a chat sometime. Yeah. Thanks. Well, you than me. I mean, it's probably one of these things.